Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, we shine a spotlight on this year's Sarasota Film Festival with seven terrific guests, including actor Joe Pantoliano and the artist who Roger Ebert called the new great American director. Coming up next on Movie Geeks United. Welcome to the show. This is Movie Geeks United. We have a packed one tonight. Seven guests, seven terrific filmmakers and cinematic artists. This is going to be a good one. Jerry, how you doing?
Hey, man, what's up? I'm doing well. This is going to be jam-packed. I mean, this is big. I mean, this is like, we haven't had this many guests on in this capacity in a very long time.
Yeah, believe me, I was... when we were conducting these interviews, I had my calculator and I was doing the math. Okay, can I possibly fit in one more guest to this 2-hour show? It's just filled up with such great talent in outstanding projects, really interesting, most of them very outside of the box kinds of projects, fascinating stuff. This is in service to the Sarasota Film Festival, which takes place beginning Friday night. Their Friday night opening film is called The Messenger with Woody Harrelson and Ben Foster, and it is a very moving portrait of military life and a very special event that's happening in conjunction with this because MacDill Air Force Base in Tampa, they're inviting about 400 or so troops from that base to attend that screening. So it's going to be a very emotional evening. That's opening night, and then myself and our DVD home theater correspondent Aaron Adidias will attend that first weekend, and then I'll go the following weekend as well. So it'll be good. The Movie Geeks will take over Sarasota.
And Keith, and you'll be joined by Keith also.
Keith Ulick, a good friend of ours, who's now a critic for Time Out,
New York. So that's awesome. I mean, it's going to be like the trio. I mean,
we'll be getting together, and what's exciting to me also is that Saturday I'll be able to meet our first guest.
That's awesome.
Let's get to our first guest right now. That's a good intro for him.
He is one.
We love this guy. He's one of the best loved actors in the business, with a jaw dropping series of credits to his name. Films like The Matrix, The Goonies, Risky Business, Midnight Run, Memento, and of course a character for the ages in the hit TV series The Sopranos. And in his latest project, Joe Pantoliano, Mr. Joey Pants, steps behind as well as in front of the camera to share insight into a subject that's close to his heart. Now, the last time we spoke to Joey, he was promoting his moving film Canvas, which follows a family as they deal with the mother's mental illness. And that film inspired a personal journey of discovery for Joey after he himself was diagnosed with mental illness. In the film No Kidding Me Too, Joey explores the genesis of his illness, speaks to others who suffer from mental disorders, and the scientists and researchers who work tirelessly to achieve a greater understanding of the disease. Now, Joey's even started his own foundation that you can read more about at www.nkm2.org. Joey loves the Sarasota Film Festival, and let me tell you, they love him too. Every year, he receives the warmest reception. I remember that when we screened Canvas a couple of years back at the film festival. And he was major. He walked in all smiles, and the audience just embraced him. And he just posed for photos, and everyone was like he'd known them forever, like his best friend. And that's the kind of personality that Joey Pants has, and that's why we love him. And moviegoers respond to him as well. No Kidding Me 2 premieres on Saturday, March 28th at 5:30 p.m. and Sunday, March 29th at 11:30 a.m. at the Sarasota Film Festival. And he'll be on hand to participate in a Q&A, I believe, following each screening. He will definitely be attending those events. Yeah.
Great.
So let us hear now from Mr. Joey Pants.
Action. I'm Joey Pantoliano, founder and president of No Kidding Me 2.
I'm Jill Santiago.
I'm Bob Irvin.
Hi, I'm Casey LaRusso.
I'm Philip Winter.
My name's Wendy Richardson.
Hi, I'm Richard Lerner.
I'm Dr. Stacey Gruber.
My name is Jordan Burnham.
Hey, I'm Rob Campbell. By trade, I'm a doctor.
I'm a Mass Sergeant in the United States Army.
I'm a professor at Tufts University.
I am a licensed marriage and family therapist in private practice.
Public speaking to college kids.
I'm a psychiatrist at McLean Hospital.
I'm a NAMI peer facilitator. I'm also a peer support specialist.
I own horses here and ride here. It's an equestrian facility. Because I'm lucky to be alive today.
By choice now.
ADHD.
Bipolar, ADHD.
Suffered traumatic brain injury in Iraq.
Dyslexia.
Schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, and bipolar disorder.
Alcoholic and addict, all in recovery.
Post-traumatic stress disorder.
Auditory processing issues.
Paranoid schizophrenic.
Depression.
Alcoholic.
Recovering self-injury.
I can remember being told that I give mental illness a bad name.
So I feel like I'm right at home.
Hi, Jamie.
Hey, Joey, how you doing?
I'm doing good, thank you.
It's a real pleasure to talk to you again. I'm very excited to attend your film at the festival this year.
I am too, brother. This is it's personal. It's actually more personal than anything I've ever done because, you know, it's somewhat autobiographical.
Yeah.
I don't even know if that's the right word because it's a documentary and it's really documenting my own journey through my spiritual awakening and my emotional awakening and how my, you know, where experience connected to, okay, look out. I connected to somebody's yelling. They're ticketing your Vespa. They're ticketing your Vespa. It's a beautiful day here, by the way. It's like 65 degrees, so Isabella and I took the Vespa out, and now we're going to get a pedicure.
Oh, wow.
But what I was saying is that my journey began almost 5 years ago. Come here, Izzy. And it was when I had a... I lost two very important people in my life, one to suicide and one to ignorance. And I was really, it was just the end of a long list of some self-destructive behavior, and some of it was genetics that I never understood how they worked.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, because I was working on canvas at that time,
right.
It was an inkling of how that this thing called mental illness was something that I could have, because I thought it was a minority illness. I didn't think it affected hardly anyone.
Right.
And then in doing all that work, I realized the numbers, the actual numbers, which is four in five Americans are affected by it, and one in four have it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that was just from the understanding of canvas and how it showed how it affects someone's family, that a mental disease.
Right. Right.
So I thought, after I understood and I was diagnosed, I thought, well, gee, how did it affect my family? And so the journey just continued, and to give you the long the short story is, I was in therapy. I was doing talk therapy. I was doing medicine, and then I got into a 12-step program. Mm. And so now once you kind of like, I was talking to Lawrence Fishburne about this just the other day. It's mm-hmm. like in the Matrix where you take the blue pill, you take the red pill, and it's taking, for me, taking the red pill was the biggest mistake. Ignorance is bliss.
Yeah. What interests me, though, is last time we spoke, you were promoting Canvas. And obviously this process of self-discovery occurred around that time you were shooting that. But you've spoken about the stigma against mental illness, and I'm wondering if you could elaborate on what that stigma is as you observe it.
Well, stigma is it a shame? In essence, it's the shame that you have for being different. For the longest time, I thought that the way I felt was my sin and my shame. Like, there was shame on me because I just couldn't appreciate the great things that I had. You know, why couldn't I appreciate the love of the loving wife that who I had adored, but I couldn't feel anything, and I couldn't feel my children any longer. And I started buying dogs. You know, one friend of mine said that she thought that I was going to become one of those dog hoarders, and the shame that I felt because I started resembling my mother. Mm. So when I was told by the doctor that what I was feeling was called clinical depression, which is that your brain produces these electrodes that are telling you that you have sadness, melancholy, but it doesn't come from anywhere. It's not like, okay, your dog died, or the doctor says you have cancer and you got mm-hmm. 6 weeks to live. It's like there's nothing but good stuff is going on and you feel terrible. It's a burden. Everything that good, every good thing that ever happened to me has been a burden. Mm-hmm. And so when the doctor said it was a disease that could be treated and with the right diagnosis and the right treatment and doing the hard work that was ahead, that I could be freed up to 80%, where now in my life I'm almost my depression is in remission. But the first thing that I did after the diagnosis is I got my next job, and in that job the doctor asked me all the benign questions that he'd been asking for 85 movies. And when I told him that I had added a medicine along with the heart medicine I was taking for my cholesterol, Lipitor, uh-huh. that I had added an antidepressant, they said that they wouldn't insure me because I took that medication, and that if I wanted to be in the movie, that I would have to sign a waiver, which would indemnify them. So if I had a nervous breakdown, that I'd be financially responsible rather than they. And I said, well, I'm taking Lipitor. What if I have a heart attack? Why is it that you're covering my heart but not the all-American brain?
Right.
And they didn't have a good answer. So that's when I went public. That's when I said, that's enough's enough, because I knew so many people in my profession that would omit that. They would say that they weren't taking antidepressants, that they weren't being medicated, so that if they actually had an episode, they would then be sued for breach of contract.
Oh, that's unbelievable. But when you decided to embark on this project and put all your creative energy behind it, what did you decide to be the form of it, the structure? What were you going after to eliminate that stigma?
Well, initially my idea was to call this documentary Hope's Messengers. And in my advocacy work with the organization, I started being asked to go and give speeches at clubhouses and clinics. And in those events, I continued to meet sterling examples of recovery. A doctor who was running a clinic called the Healing Place in Louisville, Kentucky, for the hopeless, the homeless, and the penniless, and to help them get back on recovery with the help of 12-step programs. And, you know, so he was a volunteer doctor there. He had previously been a heart surgeon, vascular and heart surgeon, and had performed, I don't know, 300 heart transplant surgeries. And he was bipolar in recovery from drug addiction and alcohol. And this guy, Philip, who I met, that was, schizophrenic with auditory hallucinations, virtually catatonic, who now was a NAMI peer support specialist, worked at a clinic, and then literally it had been reborn in a way. You know, he got his act together. He still he takes medicine every day, but he's got an active life, and he's recently been married, you know, and has a life.
Hmm.
And then all, you know, this kid Jordan, who at 17 tried to take his own life because the depression was overwhelming and the alcohol wasn't working anymore. And, so he tried to jump out of his ninth floor bedroom window and didn't die.
Hmm.
And so all of these elements of recovery that, well, you know, I mean, I always knew that if I could turn this around, anybody could. But now I had seven examples of if I could turn it around, anybody could.
Yeah.
But the movie had something else to say, which I had nothing to do with it. I just turned the camera on and I would talk to people and they would talk to me. And, you know, this recovery angle, it's one day at a time. You know, the work that I have to do to regulate and manage my own sanity is work. I do see my psychiatrist. I go to these talk groups. I do yoga now. I try to watch what I eat. I don't drink alcohol. I don't do anything that is going to technically alter the brain chemistry because, it's, you know, just the slightest thing, like exercise. I walk a lot. I try to have fun instead of, you know, moaning all the time.
But this is interesting because you have said that when you were diagnosed with mental illness, that seemed to be the best thing that ever happened to you. Did it feel like a kind of a veil had been lifted?
Oh yeah, it was like I hit the lottery. It was like, it's not my fault. It all makes sense. And then I realized, you know, that, oh my gosh, my mom, it wasn't her fault either.
Yeah.
You know, that all of the ravings, all of the, I thought that she chose to be nasty and malicious or selfish. That I thought that these were just her way of just ruining her own life, and you know, and her life affected all of us just in an overt way. If mommy was in a good mood, we were okay. If mommy was in a bad mood, and we never knew. We try to get as far away from her as possible, and I found that with my own kids.
Yeah, and back then when we're talking about our parents, the science and the research wasn't in place
wasn't
at that
there.
Time to know what it was necessarily.
Yeah. So not only are we powerless over our past, we're powerless over our parents' past, and we are defined by their genetics and also their history. That they don't, you know, also then they didn't share those family secrets. It's actually the secrets that will free us.
Yeah.
The secrets of our family where we're told don't say anything. Like, for example, with a family who's just found out that grandma has Alzheimer's. First thing they do is have a meeting to say that no one should know, when in fact, first thing they should do is organize a party as quickly as they can to have everybody that loves that person show up so they can tell him or her how much they meant to them before they forget who they are.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I did notice on your website, the film is called No Kidding Me 2, and your website is nkm2.org. And
right.
There's a place for donations. Where do those donations go?
It goes to No Kidding Me 2 for our ongoing advocacy work for getting the stigma taken care of and ended, and to have these forums and to make documentaries like this. Every nickel that we raised, we put in, well, not every, but a large portion, like I think probably 80% of what we raised from donations went into the making of this documentary.
Wow.
And so if the documentary is successful in any way, we'd have an income source, you know, like a passive income source, because, you know, with the way of nonprofits right now, it's really difficult to keep going. A lot of our resources have dried up.
Yeah, yeah, but you're showing this at the Sarasota Film Festival, and Sarasota loves you, and apparently you love Sarasota.
I do.
So, yeah, it's a great festival.
Great festival, great time of year, and it's the best part of Florida. I love, you know, I have real emotional issues with, because my father, when my mom threw him out, he wound up in Miami Beach. So I spent a lot of part of my youth in Miami Beach before it was, you know, before it was South Beach, when it was older community and a lot of poor people in that area. And I was always sad there. And, you know, this sadness that I've always felt was something that I thought that my success would make go away, or my acting would make it go away. And it's nothing anybody ever gave me. It was something I was born with.
Well, I think that I hope that the film opens up a dialogue, and I think it's going to be very useful for a lot of people. And you will be there, correct, at the film festival?
Yeah, I'll be there, and I hope everyone that reads this article comes down. There's going to be two screenings, right? A Saturday and a Sunday?
Yes, yes.
Because the awesome thing in the two test screenings we did is a tremendous need to discuss people's own personal journey with mental disease and how to get help, and patients can tell their loved ones, this is how I feel, you see, and loved ones can tell their loved ones who have the disease, this is how they feel, you know. It's and kids that are on the borderline, like in several occasions already where kids watch this and turn to their mom and dad and said, listen, I've got a problem I've not told you about, and I need help, and I don't want to be like that. You know,
yeah.
It's all about emotional intimacy.
As a non-psychiatrist doctor in training, there is a huge bias against mental illness patients in the hospital.
The sooner we get together and say, yes, it's time to put this to an end and make this on parity with other forms of health care, then they'll go along. They're not going to do it until they're forced to do it.
We as a government ought to make sure that we make the same type of an investment in those people as we do in people with physical ailments, people with economic challenges.
There's more brains in this room than there are in the Oval Office. Then I'm here till Thursday.
Yeah, that's Joey Pants talking about his new documentary effort, No Kidding Me 2, which will be shown at the Sarasota Film Festival this coming weekend.
You guys really bonded, man. No, I mean, that is very good. I mean, I enjoyed it, you know, when he was on last time, but you guys really bonded this time.
Yeah, yeah, he and I, we're going to hang. We're going to hang a little bit.
That's great. That was awesome.
Me and Joey Pants. But the website is nkm2.org for nokiddingme2.org. Find out more about the film there, view the trailer in its entirety, and read more about his foundation and the work that they do. It's very valuable, and I think he's very courageous for coming out like this. He's been all over. He's been on the Brian Williams NBC Nightly News. There's a clip of him on there on that website. He's getting the word out. I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, no, definitely.
And so that's Joey Pants. I hope you guys enjoyed it. Our next interview, are you ready to get to the next one?
Yeah, let's do it.
All righty. This is very interesting. This is a fascinating topic. Robert Kenner is one of our top documentarians. His 2 Days in October is among the top films on the Vietnam War's impact on our homeland. And he's also assumed co-directing duties on the Martin Scorsese series The Blues. In his new film, Food, Inc., Mr. Kenner tackles big business and bigger government and their monopolies over what we eat. Entertainment Weekly raves, Food, Inc. is more than a terrific movie. It's an important movie. Food, Inc. premieres on Saturday, March 28th at 4 p.m. and Sunday, March 29th at 5:45 p.m. at the Sarasota Film Festival. I really enjoyed this conversation. This is a guy that his heart is completely in the right place. He's a wonderful documentarian, and he makes movies that have something to say and can stir debate and stir conversation in people. And this is going to be a terrific film. I can't wait to catch it at the festival this weekend.
All right, here's cool.
This is a good one. Here's Robert Kenner speaking about Food, Inc.
This project went through many evolutions.
Mm-hmm.
It initially started when Eric Schlosser had written Fast Food Nation, and he was looking for someone to turn this into a documentary.
Mm.
Simultaneously, I had read his book and loved his book, and we both sort of got in touch with each other simultaneously and thought it would be great to go make a documentary based on Fast Food Nation.
Right.
A number of years transpired between the time we initially talked. I think that was like 6-7 years ago.
So this was prior to the feature film, the narrative
it
film?
It was way prior. And,
okay.
It was even prior to Supersize. And what I think happened was there were people who were interested in making it, but Eric then started to make the feature film. And then we got funding at some point, but I realized that people thought they had seen Fast Food Nation, whether it was his feature that was going to be coming out, but more importantly, they thought they had seen the documentary because of Supersize Me.
Hmm.
And I realized I needed to transform our film into something else. I also thought, even though Eric's book, Fast Food Nation, is not really about the fast food business, it's a much bigger topic.
Oh, yeah.
People thought because of Supersize Me, it had been done. I began to think I needed to make it about how all food has been industrialized, how everything has been taken over by this machine, in effect.
Yeah.
And, that I just wanted to show that this world has been really entirely transformed without us sort of noticing what's been happening. And
it's been it's been insidious, hasn't it?
It's a little like putting the frog in the boiling in the cold water and then turning the heat up. We just
mm-hmm.
it goes without us noticing, and at the same time, I think that's the real goal of agribusiness is to continue with this illusion that our food comes from farms with white picket fences and red barns, and when in reality it's huge corporate agribusiness that's producing this food on mega industrial sites.
Yeah.
And it's all been transformed without us knowing, and it's had major consequences. So our idea shifted from Fast Food Nation. I was influenced by Michael Pollan's book, Omnivore's Dilemma.
Uh-huh.
And then I was ultimately searching for what do we have that's new to say. And I think it sort of came out as we started to film.
When you knew that when you're shooting a documentary, there's so many hours of footage, how do you know when you're done? How do you know when you have what you need?
Well, it's a good question, because on this one, it was very hard because we had the construction of this film was a real challenge, because on one hand we were trying to talk about how the food that we're eating has been transformed in a very fundamental way that has not only changed how we eat, but it changed the land we live on, it changed the people who are producing it, it's changed the health of the people that are eating it, so on and so forth. So how do you tell the story in an emotional way, which is something I like to do, and at the same time, how do you tell it without a narrator, which is also something I like to do? So it really presented big challenges for us, and the challenges turned out to be even greater in that I had really hoped to tell this story from multiple points of view, from both the industrial point of view as well as the organic, you know, super farmer point of view. But I found that basically agribusiness was not very interested in talking to me. We spent an amazing amount of time approaching corporate business to include them in this project, only to be rejected continually by these companies. They just wanted to know everything we were doing. I think we were rather open in telling them. But ultimately, they did not want us. They did not want to be part of the conversation, and they did not want us to look in their kitchens. So not being Michael Moore, I didn't want to sort of have myself on the phone being rejected, but at the same time, how do you let people know this is happening? And that became a challenge in the filmmaking.
Well, forgive me if this is an insensitive question, but do you feel that your film has suffered for their lack of participation?
Yeah, I mean, I think on some levels it becomes a more interesting conversation when people come to the table.
Right.
I think that we have a food crisis in this country, and I don't think it's going to be solved by going back to farming like we did in 1900. You know, I'm not a sort of a romantic in thinking that we did everything perfectly before agribusiness existed. I think that ultimately we're not going to solve these problems unless people are ready to go think about it, talk about it, and deal with it. So certainly disappointed in terms of the big picture that they weren't ready to be there. Whether the film suffers or not, I mean, I think it sort of starts to paint the film became a much more frightening portrait of something that went way beyond food, which was not what I initially thought we were doing. It came as a big surprise to me in the course of filming that this was about a lot more than just food.
Even so, you're going against, or maybe going against is the wrong phrase, but we're dealing with major corporations, franchises, and big government. And did you know what you were in for when you started it? I would think that would be a potentially litigious endeavor.
I didn't realize how litigious this world was when I started. I think for me, the moment that really struck me and made me realize that this film was about more than food was when I was talking to a mother, a woman named Barb Kowalczyk, who's become a food safety advocate, and she was in Washington. We followed her in Washington, speaking with congressmen and people from the FDA about food safety. And then later that night, we did an interview where she talked about the death of her son. Her son died from eating a hamburger that contained E. coli. Well, her son was dying, or months after her son died, she found out that her son, the E. coli that was in the hamburger that her son ate, matched a recall of meat. But it turned out that meat was not recalled for a few weeks after her son died. So that they actually knew this meat was out there, but they didn't recall it. That's the power of this agribusiness.
Yeah.
And what I found amazing as I talked to Barb, it was a very emotional conversation talking about the death of her son. At the end, I asked her, Barb, how has this affected your eating habits? And she said that if I told you how I eat now, I would be sued. That there are people out there who are ready to sue me for saying what I don't eat.
Yeah.
And I got goosebumps. I thought, you know, how could that be? How could that be in this country that you could be sued for saying that? And she said, well, look at Oprah. You know,
exactly.
Someone was on Oprah's show and they said they didn't want to eat a burger, and someone had gotten sick from eating a burger, and it's, Oprah said it makes you think twice about that. And she was sued and spent 6 years in the courts and spent over $1 million on her defense. And there are powerful laws that protect the food industry, and there are powerful laws that prevent you from suing the food industry.
Mm-hmm.
That I had no idea about when I started this project.
The way we eat has changed more in the last 50 years than in the previous 10,000. But the image that's used to sell the food, it is still the imagery of agrarian America. You go into the supermarket and you see pictures of farmers. The picket fence and the silo and the 30s farmhouse and the green grass. It's the spinning of this pastoral fantasy. The modern American supermarket has on average 47,000 products. There are no seasons in the American supermarket. Now they're tomatoes all year round, grown halfway around the world, picked when it was green, and ripened with ethylene gas. Although it looks like a tomato, it's kind of a notional tomato. I mean, it's the idea of a tomato. In the meat aisle, there are no bones anymore.
There is this deliberate veil, this curtain that's dropped between us and where our food is coming from.
The film is going to be released by Magnolia on June 12th in New York and Los Angeles. And then we will be going wide about a week or two later to about 20 cities.
Oh, terrific.
So to the main U.S. cities. There will be a ton of, we're going on a numbers of TV shows, a lot of publicity, and there will be a lot of articles written about the show. And we're hopefully be having, looks like we'll be having a number of screenings in Washington for a number of policy people as well.
The industry doesn't want you to know the truth about what you're eating, because if you knew, you might not want to eat it.
Yeah, that's Robert Kenner. The film is Food, Inc., another one of the great documentaries being shown this year at the Sarasota Film Festival.
That's
you guys will,
fascinating.
Yeah, it's going to be a great one. And certainly you guys will see a lot more of that film in the coming months, as he attested to at the tail end of that interview.
Mm-hmm.
It's that's what I enjoy most about these festivals. It's getting a chance to take in all of this documentary work that I wouldn't otherwise be able to see.
Mm-hmm.
And it opens whole new worlds and conversations for me.
That's great. You guys really, every year, like the lineups at your festival keeps getting better and better.
Yeah, absolutely. But there's not only documentaries there. We're going to cover a couple of more documentaries as the show goes on. But let's get to one of the top narrative films that will be playing there. And I'm talking about Goodbye Solo. Yeah, have you read about this one?
Yeah, I actually have. I read about it because the director did Man Push Cart, and what's the other film? Chop Chop. So this guy is very popular. There's an article about these films in the New York Times Magazine this past weekend. So yeah.
And Roger Ebert, just this week, Roger Ebert mm-hmm. called our next guest the new great American director, and in his first two films, like you mentioned, Man Push Cart and Chop Chop. Writer-director Ramin Barani explored the lives of fascinating characters who live on the fringes of society, and he did it with great compassion and sensitivity, and those qualities also define this new film of his, Goodbye Solo, which has already won the International Critics Prize at the Venice Film Festival. It screens in Sarasota on Saturday, March 28th at 8:30 p.m. and Monday, March 30th at 5 p.m. This was a real pleasure to converse with Ramin, and here's what he had to say about his new film.
Honestly, as a young kid, I didn't really watch a lot of films. My parents weren't really movie-going people very much. I mean, my earliest memories of my parents, taking us to see films were, like all kids of my generation, me and my brother went to see Star Wars, and my mom was a fan of James Bond, so we would watch those every year. But we didn't really watch a lot of movies, to tell you the truth. I started watching more movies by the time I was in high school. I had a teacher who started introducing me to American films of the 70s. Woody Allen, Scorsese, Coppola, those kind of directors. And that kind of opened up ideas about cinema that I didn't really know about before and showed me kind of movies that I didn't know about before.
Yeah. You know, a name I often hear associated with you in terms of other filmmakers, and I don't know if you consider this a fair comparison or not, is Cassavetes.
Yeah, of course. I do like Cassavetes. Our styles are different, but there are a lot of similarities, which is, for example, women are the influence. People tend to think it's improvised acting or improvised scenes, but actually we all know that those things were very choreographed, very well planned out. Mm-hmm. None of Gina Rowland's performance is a improvisation. And so I think the naturalism that he brought is certainly not just in his camera style, but in his performance and storytelling. I think we do share those similarities.
Yeah. And what were you trying to investigate with this project?
Well, Goodbye Solo, believe it or not, the original script and idea was beginning in 2005. After Man Push Cart had premiered in Venice, I was already working on Chop Shop, but at the same time I was working on Goodbye Solo. I had met a real-life Senegalese taxi driver in a pickup soccer match I played with my brother in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, which is where I'm born and raised. I had met this driver actually even earlier, in about 2003. He was young, friendly, charming. And during the soccer match, I came to see there were a lot of Africans and a lot of taxis. And I realized that Africans were driving a lot of the taxis in Winston-Salem, which I didn't know that. And having been out of Winston for a couple of years, the demographics of the South were changing. I then saw the same driver in a gas station. He was a gas station attendant as a second job. And I came to learn that he didn't own a car. And so this taxi driver, to get to his other job or to get anywhere, had to hire a taxi or he had to walk. Huh. And the idea of a dark-skinned African man walking in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and having to hire taxis to take him to his job as a taxi driver seemed really interesting to me. And flash forward to 2005, I connected this with an elderly man and little by little started to develop the story of Goodbye Solo.
Mm. And you actually, obviously you're from Winston-Salem, you actually rode with this gentleman for about 6 weeks, if I have that correct. Is that right?
I actually spent about 6 months with him over the course of a couple of years, before Chomp Chomp, after Chomp Chomp, and then right before we were going to make Goodbye Solo. In the process, I came to learn more about the details of the business, learn more about the passengers. Also, this gentleman, he was very charming. He was very friendly. Nothing in the film, actually, the majority of the story of the film is completely fictional and is not from his real life, but he had a feeling and an atmosphere that permeated the script and then the film itself, which then another gentleman named Suleiman ended up being cast to play the lead. He's a trained actor, but it's kind of his debut film, really.
Mm. Had you always wanted to make a film in Winston-Salem?
I kind of did. I knew I would always go, return and make a film in my hometown. And I always had a feeling it would be something that we wouldn't expect from Winston-Salem.
Mm-hmm.
There is a scene in the movie where Solo is driving and there's a crack passenger in the back seat, a middle-aged Caucasian man with a younger black girl, and they're smoking up in the back. And this gentleman is actually being played by Angus McLaughlin, who is a friend and also a playwright and a screenwriter. He was a screenwriter of Junebug, which Phil Morrison made in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, because Angus and Phil are both from Winston-Salem also. And Angus said something very interesting to me, which is he said, you could show Junebug and Goodbye Solo back-to-back. Nobody would believe they're the same town, and they're both completely honest and accurate about that town. What I tried to show was a part of Winston-Salem that I personally didn't know growing up. In fact, in the making of the film, like in all my films, I come to learn about people and a portion of a city or a portion of a society that I personally didn't know about, and that's one of the things that excites me to make the films.
Yeah.
You know, unlike New York, if you're going to take a taxi, you know, people who take taxis in New York tend to be a little bit more, you know, well-to-do financially. In a suburb like Winston-Salem, North Carolina, if you're taking a taxi, it means you can't afford a car, or you can't afford car insurance, or you can't afford to repair a car, all the things that go with a car. So 90% of the customers were financially not really well off. Occasionally you would get someone who had to go to a, you know, airport, or their car broke down, and it was a rare thing for them. So, and I was also doing the night shift with this driver, so we were taking a lot of people to and from, you know, third shift jobs, you know, really, really working class people, oftentimes quite poor. In Winston-Salem, North Carolina, that was predominantly African Americans and Hispanics, and then occasionally, you know, very, very working class Caucasians as well. And this was a portion of the city I didn't know much about. And I found it really exciting to learn about it.
Yeah, it had to be very kind of cathartic for you in a way to rediscover the people of your hometown. That's what it sounds like to me.
Very much so. And, I mean, it's also the film has, you know, represents the changing demographics of the South. You have to remember North Carolina voted for Obama, and this could not have happened 4 years ago or 8 years ago or 12 years ago. And I say all this cautiously because you know my films and you know me as a filmmaker. The film is not a message film because for those of you who don't know the story is about Solo who was hired in the very beginning of the film by William, an old Southern man who wants Solo to take him to a mountaintop called Blowing Rock in 2 weeks' time where he plans to jump and kill himself. Now, on paper, we may be talking about this film and suddenly the audience may think to themselves, oh, this is going to be like a angelic black guy comes to save old white guy, or The Bucket List, or Legend of Bagger Vance, or and the movie's not like that at all. In fact, I don't like those films, and if you've seen my other films, you know that that's not what you're going to get. But for those people in your audience who don't know, I want to really stress that's not what this film is.
Well, something that all of your films have in common, they feature just extraordinary performances and performers. And this is an interesting duo, your two leads here. How did you happen upon them?
Yeah, it's the first time that my leads are professionally trained actors. In the past, my leads have always been non-professionally trained.
Mm-hmm.
The supporting casting did by Solo is all non-professional, local, non-actors that have been put into the film. Solo, Suleiman, his nickname is Solo, we looked in North Carolina. When the real guy said he didn't want to be in the film, we had to find somebody to play the part. And so we looked in North Carolina, L.A. Tapes came from various African countries. Tapes came from England. I went to France. And one day Solo came into the office in New York. Physically, he was perfect. He was charming, friendly, open, curious. And believe it or not, he had been a flight attendant for 2 years for Air Afrique. And in the script, the character's dream is to become a flight attendant. So it was almost, you know, too good to be true. It was like such a crazy coincidence. And so he, playing the part of Solo, he has an amazing face and it's a great performance. The other character, the old man, William, is played by Red West.
Yeah.
If you don't know Red West, Red West is Elvis Presley's childhood best friend. I'm talking back when Elvis was a scrawny kid getting, you know, beaten up in school. This was the guy protecting him.
Mm.
And when Elvis became Elvis, Red became part of the Memphis Mafia, part of his personal bodyguard. And then Elvis became stuntman and a bit player in a lot of the Elvis films. When Elvis passed, Red West went on to become a Hollywood character actor, working with Coppola, Altman, Oliver Stone, and in big Hollywood fare like Roadhouse and Glory Road. And this is actually his first leading role at the age of 71, which I'm especially proud to say that it's in this film. It's a big honor for me to work with him.
Yeah, just reading about these two actors, it's an amazing duo and amazing life journeys that both of them have had. You as a director, when you are working and collaborating with these actors, what is your process with them? Do you spend a lot of time in rehearsals?
I do a lot of rehearsals. Here the process is a little different. In the past, and with all the supporting cast of Goodbye Solo, and in my previous films, I never show the script. There's a very detailed script. Everything in the film is pretty planned out and pretty meticulously planned out, and usually repeated over and over again in many takes and very detailed script. Here, I showed the two leads the script, and I've never done that before. They were both better performers with the script, which was different for me, but I respected that they were better that way, and I had to move myself to match them.
Mm-hmm.
Solo came to live with me and my brother for 3 months in North Carolina and actually drove a taxi. And I mean really drove a taxi to make money with real customers. And he really got into the business of it. He learned the people. He met the real driver, which helped his performance, I think. Part of the rehearsals, for example, in the film, he's married and has a stepdaughter. And the stepdaughter is the third biggest part in the film. Initial rehearsals with the stepdaughter was just them going and having lunch together.
Yeah.
Spending time, becoming really friends, and then some feeling of possibly, you know, in real life, maybe she would look at Solo as her uncle or something like that, that would really make their bond in the film something special.
Yeah.
And then Red West came for a couple of weeks before the film, and we rehearsed extensively. I remember when Red showed up, he asked me if we were going to do a table reading. And I asked him, I said, what is a table reading? I didn't even know.
Yeah.
And he proceeded to tell me that it was to sit at a table and read the script. And I said, well, Red, with all due respect, I don't know what that is, and it doesn't seem like a movie to me. Can we just rehearse the scenes on location with my cameraman, a handy cam, and the actors in the space? And he said, oh, well, I'm open to that idea. And that's how I tend to work. I like to rehearse extensively with the actors on location with a handy cam. That seems like
the
beginning
terrific.
Of the process, you know?
Yeah. And when you talked about how he spent time with the stepdaughter character, and that reminds me of someone else, how they work, and Mr. West has worked with this gentleman, Coppola. Rehearsals for him, it's more about establishing a comfort zone with one another, because the whole company there has such a family feeling in every one of his films. I think that's more valuable than sitting and reading the lines together, certainly.
I think so, too. There's a character named Brock who plays – he's a real taxi driver who plays Solo's best friend in the film, and they spent time together. They went and shot pool together. They had drinks together, and that was part of the rehearsal with him. I would stress, by the way, Rock insists that his name is not R-O-C-K. It is R-O-C because K is for killin' and C is for chillin', and Rock is a chiller, he says. And in the film, he's not only his best friend, but he's also a drug dealer. So he wants to say that he's a chiller.
Let me ask you about the film festival experience. You've had tremendous success with all of your films, and this one in particular won the International Critics Prize at Venice, I believe.
Yes.
What is the value of that beyond getting the word and the exposure out about your film? What do you learn about your film and your audience by attending those festivals?
Well, it's always a good chance, especially I've premiered all my films in Europe, Man Push Card in Venice, Challenge Shop in Cannes, and then Solo again in Venice. And then I premiere in the States after that. One, I like to see the reaction in different countries, especially the difference between Europe and America. If there are differences, what they might be. I always like seeing the film where the movie was shot. For example, Push Card and Chomp Shop, I was always curious to see what would New York audience think of it. In April, I'm going to be in River Run Film Festival in North Carolina, where the movie was shot in Winston.
Yeah.
So I'm very curious what Winston-Salem will think. Specifically with Solo, it was a pleasure and a relief to know that the humor worked. Unlike my first two films, this one has quite a bit of humor, especially in the first half of the film. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know if it was a smiling humor, a chuckling humor, or a kind of laughing humor. Mm. And we were relieved that it was kind of a laughing humor for about half the film. And I wasn't really expecting it to be that, for people to think it was this humorous. And that was a kind of a real relief. And always there's audience members that will pose you a question or tell you a feeling they had that you never really knew about, that you even knew was in the film. Mm-hmm. And so that's always a great pleasure with meeting audiences, because you learn something new about your film. And then I have to confess, I take that and I go to the next festival and I pretend like I made it up. I thank the audiences for that. They always give me good kind of quotes to give in interviews and Q&A.
Yeah, great sound bites, yeah. Sir, I appreciate your time so much, and I can't wait to see your movie. And thank you so much for taking time out to talk to us today.
Well, I appreciate it, and I appreciate all the support. I'm hoping you and the audiences are going to really like Goodbye Solo.
Hi, my name is Solo. It's nice to meet you. I'm used to talking to all kinds of people, and I get along with them. People are happy in my cab, and I know how to handle the ones that aren't so friendly. I think that's very important for this job. I don't want to drive a cab. I've been doing that for 3 years. I don't want to drive a cab.
You told me it would cost $200. Well, I'll give you $1,000 to take me there on October the 20th.
You want me to take you on top of some mountain where you're not meeting nobody, and you don't want to come back? Why do you want to do this?
6464, have you ever heard of this place called Blowing Rock?
Blowing Rock is the only place in the world where the snow goes upside down.
What's going on, man?
Well, my apartment. Moving into a motel.
You have family here, right? Why don't you move in with them? Why don't family stay together in America?
Mom wants to talk to you.
I'm sick of you and that taxi. I don't want you in my house.
Thinking maybe for a couple of days,
no? No room.
This place is huge, man. In Africa, 10 people can sleep in here.
Who the hell told you to come here?
Let's go! It's party time tonight, man!
Yo, cheers, William!
Woo! That's what I'm saying, big dog.
William, I want to help you.
Who told you you could get into my life?
Sit down! I want you to get your things, leave, and don't come back.
Get out!
You told me you had no kids. Why are you lying to me? I'm telling you everything.
My wife left me 30 years ago.
I'm sorry to hear that.
You know we love you, and you know that we want what's best for you.
Yo, William, you know about cars? Can you give me a hand here?
I rode a motorcycle.
Yo, got tattoo, right? Oh, my God. Original player! Yeah. Yeah. I want to know, where you want to go to that mountain?
Do you ask all your passengers why they want to go places?
Sometimes I do. And when they find ladies, I ask even more, man.
Ramin Barani. The film is called Goodbye Solo, and it's showing at the Sarasota Film Festival, along with all of these terrific films we're spotlighting tonight. And that's a successful filmmaker there.
Yeah, it is. That's not what I expected. That was a really good interview. I didn't know what I was expecting, because I've never
heard of
it.
You're expecting a terrible interview.
No. I mean, I didn't.
I love
know
how
what
you said
expect.
That.
No, I didn't. Jesus Christ.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, that did. But no, it's not what I expected. From him. I mean, I've read stuff about him before, but no, that was really good. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, he's a great, very warm, generous guy, and I think his films reflect that as well. And if you read reviews of this movie, and obviously all of his films have been very, very critically acclaimed and well-received by audiences,
mm-hmm.
This film you hear praises like it makes you believe in movies again. And,
right.
Very kind of uplifting but non-cliché handling of these characters.
Well, that's the impression I got. I like you said, well, it's not like The Bucket List or The Legend of Bagger Vance. I hate those movies.
Yes.
That was great.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Another great one that I can't wait to see at that festival. And we will be back in 2 weeks, by the way. And when we come back, we have a full slate of guests for that first show when we come back on Wednesday. I believe Ron Perlman's going to be with us.
Oh, cool.
John Turteltaub will be with us.
Wonderful.
John Debney will be with us.
Yes. You tell him why John Debney, the composer, is going to be on.
Hannah Montana.
I think it's so cool.
It's really the only film that you can follow up The Passion of the Christ with. It's Hannah Montana.
Right.
It's quite an artist right there.
Yes.
We'll be talking about the films that from the Sarasota Film Festival, and you guys will hear even more insight into the films months and months before you're able to see them yourself, unless you're fortunate enough to live near a great festival like Sarasota. Let's get to our next guest.
Let's do
this. This is fascinating, man. Brock Enright, Good Times Will Never Be the Same. This is a documentary that's showing at the film festival this year. So a great filmmaker. And it's a portrait of an artist, but a very specific artist, Brock Enright. Very controversial.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about his path to creating probably his most challenging artistic endeavor. And it's very strained by kind of a violent, sexually explicit overtone, this creation that he's been commissioned to make. And this is really interesting. I almost couldn't believe what I was hearing with the director of this film, Jody Lee Lipus, was discussing how he came to know Brock Enright, that working situation.
Right.
So listen up for this. I didn't know that this kind of work existed, but apparently it does. Here's Jody Lee Lipus talking about his new film, Brock Enright.
You never know. I mean, maybe this show really sucks, and it's going to be the worst thing I've ever done. It's the risk that you're supposed to take. This is the first time working with Kirsten and making something together, kind of. I've never had shit. Never. What have I had? Name it.
You've had attention, you've had support, you've had love.
I have to keep fighting, I have to keep trying to do a new project, get myself off the ground. And every time, it just goes here and then falls, here and then falls. All these people want me to do these shows and stuff, but there's no way to survive. The work's not selling, nothing's happening, I'm a failure.
Not everybody's gonna fucking accept and understand what you do. You know how hard it is for grandpa to fucking accept and understand what you do? And that's somebody who fucking loves you.
I'm done. Let's shoot some more.
You went to NYU, right?
I did go to NYU, yes. I graduated in 2004. And the producer of my film, Kyle Martin, and the editor, Lance Edmonds, also went to NYU, and we were all in the same class there.
Wow.
So, yeah.
So you knew you wanted to be a director?
Well, actually, when I was at NYU, I really focused on cinematography, and my day job is really cinematography. You know, I've shot some features, and, you know, last year, After School, directed by Antonio Campos, which premiered at Cannes, and Wild Combination, A Portrait of Arthur Russell,
yes,
which was directed by Matt Wolff, which premiered at Berlin. Both of those guys I went to school with also, and they, you know, they direct those films. And so that's sort of been my focus for a long time, and this is my first feature as a director. But it's definitely something that I want to continue doing.
Yeah, you've done exceptional work as a DP. So, were there certain DPs that were particularly influential to you?
Yeah, definitely. I think I always really liked Robbie Mueller's work. He's a big influence on me. And definitely Harris Savides is probably the greatest in my mind. And Gordon Willis, you know, I think is also one of the greatest DPs that ever lived. So those guys have all had a big influence on me, not just in how I shoot, but just how I think about filmmaking in general. So
yeah, you look at the resume of somebody like Harris or Gordon, and it's incredible. It's the history of film right there, the best filmmaking. So how did this project come to you, or how did you, how were you aware of Brock Enright, of this subject?
Well, Brock dated my ex-girlfriend, and she introduced me to him. We met at a party, and at the time he was working on a project called Video Games Adventure Services, which was a kidnapping for hire service, which is kind of like the plot of the movie The Game, but he's been doing it a lot longer, and it's real. And so he does these sort of staged kidnappings for clients, and he videotapes the entire thing and makes sort of like a film of it that the client stars in and that he gives you at the end. So it's called Video Games Adventure Services. And
Wait a minute. Back up. So people hire him to kidnap someone on video as a practical joke?
It can be. I mean, I would compare it more to like bungee jumping than to a practical joke. It can get really violent and pretty rough, and you know, sometimes even sexual, and sometimes, you know, it's basically like whatever these people, you know, there's a very detailed interview process, and whatever these people want, he will create. It's all legal and everything, but, you know, they can get pretty elaborate and pretty explicit and pretty intense. So I worked as the cinematographer for him on several of these kidnappings, which he was doing for a long time, and he actually got a lot of media attention for that. He was on, you know, he was in Rolling Stone, and he was in, like, Good Morning America and The View. It's kind of a big deal, like, 5 or 6 years ago. And so I was shooting a lot of these things for him, and also just sort of his art films that he was creating over the past 5 years. And so when he got this big opportunity to have this show at Perry Rubenstein Gallery, he asked me to shoot the film that he was making for that show. And I just turned him down because I'd really wanted to tell the story of his life for a long time, and I thought that this was a good place to start. So,
was he receptive to that?
Yeah, he was incredibly supportive and receptive. There have been some pretty big name documentary filmmakers that have tried to make films about him, and he's turned them all down. I think because we had worked together so much in the past, and he really trusted me being there with him when he was working, he was really willing to accept that I was going to be there in this capacity. So it worked out really well.
So tell me what, beyond the kind of work that he does and the kind of artist that he is, tell me about the man himself. What makes him so magnetic for you to base your film upon?
Well, I mean, I've been thinking a lot about that over the past few months and why I was interested in telling his story. And I think that I'm really interested in telling stories about people that try really hard at what they do or excel at what they do or just sort of put everything that they have into their craft or their job or, you know, some aspect of their life. I mean, to me, that's what Brock is. He's somebody who's 150% in his work at all times. And the thing that made this story interesting to me was this was kind of a new part of that process, because he was, for the first time, he was sort of juggling these other things in his life while he was doing his work, which include, you know, his girlfriend, his financial concerns, her family, this, you know, big gallery that he had never really grappled with politically, like something that size in terms of the gallery world. So it was like the conflict between this guy who's just like 150% doing his work full on against all of these factors in his life that he has to balance for the first time. And so that just created a really interesting dynamic to film.
Well, from what I've read of the film, and I can't wait to watch it, it's been referred to as a hybrid type film. There's narrative elements and of course the documentary format as well. But is that accurate? And how did you come to that decision to form it in that manner?
Well, I mean, I've been hearing that a lot too, which is interesting to me. But I the film is actually a very strict verite documentary. There are no interviews. There's nothing that is staged in any way. But people keep telling me, I'm in Austin right now at Southwest, and I keep hearing that from journalists and people that everyone, or a lot of people, think that we staged things, which is, I think, is a compliment. I think part of the reason that people have come to that conclusion is because I just, from my background, which is, you know, very technical and visually based, because I am a DP, and, you know, I just worked really hard to make the film look nice, kind of.
Yeah.
So I think it's not something that people are really used to with the verite documentary form. You know, there's very little handheld in my film. It's mostly sort of locked off
okay.
shots and stuff like that. So I think people associate that with a narrative visual grammar, but so I think they get a little thrown. And I also think that, you know, the things that are happening in the film are kind of like so intense and emotional, and my presence in the room is felt so little that I think people get a little confused because it seems set up maybe because of that. So yeah, I'm still trying to figure it out myself, but I think that's why people say that. And the other issue is that, you know, Brock is making a film in the film. So he's like shooting actors acting, and that's in my film in a verite way. So sometimes maybe people get a little confused about what's actually happening and what he's shooting in his film. So it's a little complicated.
Yeah. Tell me about, you mentioned South by Southwest, and we spoke about it a little earlier before the interview started, but you've premiered at South by Southwest. It's the first time, I take it, that you've shown it to a public audience.
Right.
And I'm curious, that must have been nerve-wracking. It could be nerve-wracking for any filmmaker. What was the reaction, and what were the conversations that transpired by people that had seen it and approached you about it?
Well, I'm under the impression that, you know, some people are going to have, or I think most people are going to have a very strong reaction to this film, that, you know, that they're going to like it a lot or they're going to hate it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so far people have been really positive to my face. But yesterday I did a screening, and a couple people got kind of upset about it and had some pretty negative things to say, and were sort of just upset about, I think what it comes down to is that, you know, contemporary art can be a little bit frustrating to people sometimes, and it's hard to kind of like categorize it and understand why it is what it is and why there's so much money involved and why people think it's such a big deal. And so I think people get a little frustrated by that because they're like, why is this important? Why is this person being treated as if they are a celebrity, or, you know, as if they are important in the art world when they're just making these things which don't have any weight to the viewer. So, I mean, I think what I tried to do, you know, because I was well aware that could be a big issue, is I tried to make the film not be about art, like not about the specific art that Brock was making. And I actually barely even show what he's making in the film. Instead, I really wanted to make it about the people and the struggle that they're going through, and like the family dynamic.
Yeah.
So I definitely think people are going to have really split reactions to the film, and I think that's a good thing.
I think that's a great thing, and I think that's how you know you're onto something. The worst audience reaction would be apathy.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
At least they feel strongly about it one way or another.
Yeah,
I can't wait to see it.
Oh, great, great.
I hear birds chirping and everything in the background. It sounds like the most peaceful place. Are you? Where are you? So I can put the image to the sound.
The banks of the river in Austin.
Wow.
Right under the Congress Street bridge, which is where all the bats fly out from. So,
that's great. That's great.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I can't wait to meet with you, my friend. And thank you so much for giving me your time today.
Yeah, this is a great interview. Thank you so much.
Okay, that's Jody Lee Lipes, and I'm probably massacring his name. Well, I apologize if I am. The film is Brock Enright. I'm really looking forward to that one.
Fascinating guy.
Yeah, great guy. Yeah. A great guy. And I love the sounds that were coming out of that.
Yeah,
the other end of that phone.
Someone said it sounded like the Amazon.
It's so serene.
Yeah,
said, well,
no, it was nice. It was nice.
And those are hundreds of bats. And I was thinking it would be great if every guest called from a bat cave.
Yeah, no, really.
Yeah, Brock Enright. Let me tell you the times it plays at the Sarasota Film Festival. Friday, April 3rd at 9:45 p.m. Sunday, April 5th at 6 p.m. That's a great one. And also, look through our archives, because our recent archives, because we have other Sarasota Film Festival coverage. We spoke to the director of programming a couple of weeks ago and learned what kind of goes into, what factors go into building a festival's roster of films and events. And we also spoke to John Voight and Burt Young and Nick Dawson, who was a biographer, about Hal Ashby and his previously unseen cut of Looking to Get Out, which will world premiere at the festival this year, part of a larger retrospective. And a couple of months ago, when we did our Sundance show, we spoke to the filmmaker Dana Hines Perry, who did Boy Interrupted, heartbreaking story and a really touching interview about her son and his mental illness, another film that shines a spotlight on that issue, and which sadly took his life when he was a teenager. He took his own life. Very emotional movie, and I'm checking that out for the first time at the festival, too. Another one, Jerry, you and I spoke to, another very interesting filmmaker, Darius Martyr.
Right.
His film is Loot, and this sounds like... It's a documentary, but it almost sounds like the plot of a great narrative caper film, almost.
Yes, it does.
Fascinating. Back to World War II, it concerns veterans of World War II, a hidden treasure.
Right, yeah.
They go searching for. I mean, this
sounds
like a real...
Kelly Heroes meets Miracle at Santa Ana, so, I mean...
There you go. There you go. That's pretty good. We had a great time discussing the film with Darius Martyr, and here is that conversation. The film is called Loot. It plays Friday, April 3rd at 5:15 p.m. and Sunday, April 5th at 4 p.m. at the Sarasota Film Festival. And you can find all of these dates and more information about the 160 films that Sarasota Film Festival will be featuring in the events and interviews and conversation series and tribute shows and reviews. At their website at www.sarasotafilmfestival.com. Here's Darius Martyr.
Well, the documentary is called Loot, and it's the central character of the story is a used car salesman from Utah who it actually happened to know two World War II veterans who looted a treasure during World War II and now, 60 years later, want his help in order to find them. These treasures, one in Austria and one in the Philippines. So, he's a used car salesman from Utah, and I live in Brooklyn. And I had just quit all my work to make a film. I didn't really know what film I was going to make, and I just knew I was going to make one. And I sat down on a park bench in Prospect Park near where I live, and I was watching my son play in the sandbox, and I met this guy. This guy sat down next to me, this guy who just moved from Utah. And we got to talking, and he asked what I do. And I said I was a filmmaker because that was all I was doing at the time. And he said, oh, really? And he said, you know, I always thought this would be a great story. And he starts describing this used car salesman from Utah. And I just kind of looked at him and said, yeah, it's a great story. And he started, you know, he described how he wanted to take it. What at that point, which was one guy back to Austria to find a treasure. I said, yeah, that's a great sounding story. I said, I want to make that film. He's like, great, I'll produce it. And he said, what have you made? And I said, nothing. And he said, great. I said, all right, excellent. So you'll produce. And he said, oh, I don't really know what that means, but yes. And so we flew out 3 days later to Utah and started making this film. It was very sudden and it was very impulsive, but it also was one of those things that when it happens, you know.
Uh-huh.
You know you're going to do it. And it was great. You know, we met for drinks later that night and said, all right, how are we going to do this? And we did it. The moment I heard about the story, I really thought that it sounded great for a number of reasons. One is that you had this story that seemed full of folly on the one hand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have this character, this used car salesman who was immediately described as like a kind of a bumbling guy who would surprise you in how he, in his actions, like you think you know what he's about, but you don't quite, and he's an inventor, and he's kind of hard to put a finger on. I kind of like the sound of that.
Right.
And then the fact that he knew a veteran who was mostly blind, who wanted to find his looted World War II treasure, was also had some folly in it, just in the sense that he was kind of, you know, partially blind. But also there was this creeping sensation of this other story there, this other telling of the Greatest Generation. You know, this, you know, we haven't heard a lot of these stories,
yeah.
You know, it wasn't your normal World War II journey. And so right off the bat, I felt really strongly like here's a chance to tell a story that really is not a historical documentary at all,
mm-hmm.
but a journey
yeah.
towards something. And in the process of moving towards that object, you might, the more interesting or darker, or I don't really know what truths about that war might surface or might bleed into the moment. And that really interested me. So that's kind of where I started. And I thought, I really want to see where that premise will take me. You know, rather than going in and trying to, like, sitting them down in a room and just interviewing
yeah.
the hell out of them.
Right.
I wanted to see how this journey lived. And how that truth would kind of come to the surface,
right?
Mm.
If the truth existed at all, or what the truth was, or you know, I didn't know in the beginning, of course.
Yeah, but even so, you had something like 450 hours of footage, on this film. And what was the most difficult part of was it finding a tone or consistency, or what was difficult for you in that process?
Well, it's definitely editing. I mean, you know, the shooting is grueling.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so active and engaging, and you know, it's nothing compared to the editing. I mean, the editing is just where it you know, it gets made, and you know, when you're dealing with that much footage, it's such an unbelievable task, and it's kind of like you have to pace yourself. I found I had to deal with a lot of real lows, you know, where you're the only one who's kind of sitting in this room with all this footage and trying to make sense of it. And that there's no doubt that that's the hardest part, or for, you know, the most grueling part of the process.
It was a story you kind of wish you never heard, to be honest.
So we just filled our pockets, and we had army clothes on. You had big pockets, you know. We filled our pockets with jewelry and took off.
I buried some Japanese swords, some jewelry.
You're going to be a rich man, man. Lamborghini, Porsche, Ferrari.
And guess where I'm at? In Star, Austria, where the war ended.
Who speaks English here?
Before I die, I want to go back and see if that treasure and that box is there.
If there's any chance of ever finding that, we've got to find that map.
It's probably right in here someplace. As you can see, I've got stuff just almost everywhere.
This home that we stayed in had a picket, white picket fence around it.
Watches were a premium over there. I took that thing from him, and I shot him too. You ever have a feeling like you shouldn't go someplace that you go anyway?
I'm having that feeling right now. World War II vets have a real squeaky clean image, but that was ugly, dude.
As a kid, you do things like that. We took everything. Everything we saw, we took.
What the hell was it? What did I do?
Somebody out there?
No.
I kind of freaked out a little bit.
I didn't do everything just 100% right.
I was just saying to someone at the last festival I was at True False, how lucky we are that there are all these festivals, you know? I mean, it might not be that way, and it just happens to be that way. And that's the way it's set up. And, you know, in other art forms, that doesn't exist, you know? There aren't these festivals where you go and just get to celebrate your work. And I feel so fortunate to be able to go to these festivals and have people, you know, care.
Yeah.
And come and watch and talk about it. I mean, it's amazing. And it's an incredible feeling, and it's been amazing. It's been really engaging. You know, I've gotten great questions, not all easy questions, not all easy responses. Certainly, like you said, there's been some success, but I've also been really satisfied to see that the film, you know, really engages a thought process in people that is not cut and dry, and it's not always predictable.
Right.
Which kind of pleases me, even though it's hard sometimes.
Okay, that's Darius Martyr. He's the filmmaker, and the film is Loot. Interesting movie.
Yeah, very interesting.
Yeah. Let's get to our next interview.
Okay.
This is a film called Children of Invention. This is a narrative work. It's about two young kids who are living illegally in an apartment outside Boston, and they're left to fend for themselves when their mother disappears.
Mm-hmm.
Very challenging for this writer-director. Apparently he has a magical gift for it, for directing young children, and apparently he's gotten really terrific young child actors for his leads in this
mm-hmm.
movie.
Let me ask you, just from before we get into the interview, this sounds very familiar, like a Japanese movie I saw a couple years ago on Nobody Knows, where children are living on their own in an apartment in Tokyo. Just reminded me of that from your description.
Yeah, he based this on, let me look that up, he based this on a short film that he did.
Oh, okay. All right.
Was this a short film that you saw?
No, this is a very long movie, actually, but
it just sounds familiar,
that's all. But no, it sounds curious, yeah.
Children of Invention is the name of the film, and the filmmaker, his name is Zee Chun, and here he is speaking about his film.
I guess the film is about two children who are left to fend for themselves when their mother's arrested for taking part in a illegal Ponzi scheme. And I think the family dynamic was something that was very personal. I grew up with my mom and my little sister. My parents are divorced, and I spent a lot of my childhood from maybe the ages of 8 through 14 following my mom around to these Ponzi scheme seminars. And, there's usually, a speaker, and you're looking around the room as a kid, and you're seeing the desperation on these people's faces as they're trying to get themselves out of this financial hole. And, that was something that stayed with me, throughout my life. And, when it came to making my first feature, I thought that it might be an interesting thing to explore. I never really When I first wrote the script, it was supposed to take place in the early 90s. I couldn't have imagined that it would be as timely as it is now, you know, coming out right now in this financial climate.
That was my thought as soon as you started describing it. Tell me about how you went about doing this. I'm sure that it was very daunting, your first feature film. Tell me a little bit about that process and what you feel you learned about yourself in taking this on.
I didn't go to graduate school. I went to Columbia undergrad, and I did film studies, which has no production component to it.
Mm-hmm.
So I always wanted to make movies, even during high school, and I always kind of supplemented my education with my own projects. And so when I graduated from undergrad, I kind of just made a schedule for myself that I was going to make a short film every 6 months and write a feature film every 9 months. So I made 12 no-budget independent shorts over about 3.5-4 year period, and the 11th one was Window Breaker. I did feel like I had a good idea of, you know, I kind of learned a lot through those shorts, and, you know, I was really excited to, you know, put all that into practice with this feature. And, you know, the feature is relatively, it was a small crew, it was a very intimate, you know, family setting, you know, in terms of the cast and crew. We were all kind of in it together. And, you know, surprisingly, I feel like the best kind of, like, film stories are, like, when everything goes wrong, you know? But for this movie, actually, I had very few complaints, and everything went really, really smoothly. So
wow.
I don't know. I wish I had some better stories, but actually, it was pretty smooth.
I was wanting an Apocalypse Now kind of production story here.
All the big mistakes, you know, I made during my shorts, which is, I guess, kind of the point of making shorts, you know. I learned on one of my shorts never to drive the equipment van, because I was driving it one morning at 5 a.m. I was thinking about the shot list, and I drove the car into my friend's house, basically, breaking it along on the pillars. And there were all sorts of mistakes that got made leading up to this film that, you know, kind of caused this film to be a little bit less kind of accident prone.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's just like you said, your experience in short films. I mean, that's the great learning curve to graduate to features. And tell me about the two children that you work with in this film. Obviously, I'm sure it helps to have extraordinary children, but how did you go about directing them and getting out the performances that you wanted?
I think that the most important part of the direction process for a movie like this, with very young child leads, one was 7 and one was 10, it all starts with casting. And we knew from the very beginning that we just really did not want to compromise when it came to casting. So we looked at about 250 kids from New York City public schools, and we were looking for a long time, for maybe a month and a half, and one of my friends who was a casting director actually suggested Crystal Chu and Michael Chen, who are two leads. And they had never acted before, but they had been previously cast in a cut scene from Transformers 2. And it's pretty funny, they were supposed to play a brother and sister standing in front of a green screen of Hong Kong, and they're like eating ice cream in the audition tape, and then they see a giant robot and get vaporized or something. we kind of just fell in love with we just kind of fell in love with these kids, and with Window Breaker has even younger child leads, 4 and 5 years old, and and a lot of that dialogue in that film is me sitting off camera just talking to the kids and prompting them, and then trying to get the dialogue through, just asking them questions and going back and forth. But with this film, we really had a pretty tight script, and so we wanted to find kids who could read the script, memorize it. And I think Michael and Crystal, they were a good combination of they understood what movie acting was, but they had never done it before, so they were still kind of naive and innocent, and they brought a kind of spontaneity to the project.
Oh yeah.
In terms of directing the kids, I feel like the the most difficult thing as a director when you're directing kids is to not underestimate the kids' abilities. And these two kids were absolutely fantastic. And most of the time when there was some type of a problem with the scene, you know, the main thing was just not to start directing them like their object, you know, like faster or slower or sadder, and actually just talk to them about what the scene is and, you know, explain to them, you know, ask them questions like, what happened right before this? Why are you saying this? And when the kids are able to kind of internalize all of that, they, you know, it always ends up being a richer performance.
Yeah, and children are remarkably more open than we are as adults. So I think what you just said speaks to that as well. I'm curious about your Sundance experience because you took Window Breaker to Sundance, I believe, in something like 2007, and then you returned with this feature film, Children of Invention. What did that experience do for you?
You mean just generally or career-wise or?
Both.
You know, I spent a lot of time after doing my undergrad making short films, and so, you know, to get into Sundance, it was just the best possible scenario. And also for Window Breaker, you know, I had the budget for it was minuscule. It was $600, the entire production budget of Window Breaker. And when we got into Sundance, it cost another $1,200 to step up to HD. But it was an outcome that I could have kind of never imagined. And it was really my entryway into the film business and learning more about, you know, because when you're first starting out, you're just trying to get good at making films. You know, you're not that. It's hard to concern yourself with, you know, how you're going to finance your first feature or something like that when you still think of yourself as, you know, not ready for that. And so I think that getting into science that first year and then going to all the subsequent festivals, it gave me a lot of confidence in terms of. You know, feeling like, okay, well, now I do feel like I'm ready for that next step.
Yeah.
And, you know, in terms of, like, an actual experience, in 2007, I was so stressed out. I felt like, you know, I had 10 days to make something of myself or else I'll disappear forever. So I went around. I shook everyone's hand. I, you know, got germs on my hand. I made myself sick. I had the flu for the last 5 days. And this time going back, I got a flu shot, and that was probably the best thing that I learned.
That's great. But the festival circuit, Children of Invention is playing at a variety of festivals just this month, including the Sarasota Film Festival. What is that experience like for you, the interaction with the audience? What do you see that they get from this film, and what are the conversations that transpire after they watch it?
Well, it's really interesting. You know, we went to Sundance, which is, you know, the biggest film festival in the United States, and then we went straight to the San Francisco Asian American Film Festival, which is the biggest Asian American film festival. And, you know, it's definitely interesting to see the two different takes on the film. What was great about Sundance was, you know, I consider this film, and I think that the producers consider this film to be, you know, an American film first and an Asian American film second.
Right.
You know, it's not so much about identity. The identity, the Asian American kind of identity on top of the film is it's just another angle. But the film is really about, I think, family, and you know, it's a bigger story than just an Asian American story. And that was what was so great about Sundance was, you know, the people who came up to us afterwards to say that they related to the characters. There was no kind of, you know, thread that ran through them like a. They weren't a certain age, they weren't a certain race, it was really nice to see that the film played well to, you know, a variety of people from, you know, different sexes and socioeconomic backgrounds or races. And in the Asian American community, even though, you know, the film shows a number of different people that aren't just Asian American getting into these Ponzi schemes, and that was kind of my experience growing up. It was kind of a multicultural, you know, it doesn't discriminate. But that being said, a lot of I guess Ponzi schemes, pyramid schemes, are kind of endemic to the Asian American population, and so there was a lot of talk of that during the Q&As. A lot of people have had those experiences trying to talk family members out of pyramid schemes, or people who had members of their family who were, you know, currently involved in pyramid schemes.
Mm. I think that it speaks to, from what I understand of it, and I can't wait to see it, it speaks to the American dream in a way, and the desire to reach for that dream, and how many people are duped by that.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And there's, you know, that was something that was, I mean, it's always kind of part of the pitch, right? You go to these pyramid scheme seminars, and it's never about the product, because the product's just a cipher. It's you know, skin cream or
right.
or health products, vitamins. You know, but what they're really selling you is hope. They're selling you the hope that you can move forward and
mm-hmm.
you know, achieve some type of stability for your family, achieve some type of financial stability for future generations. And that's kind of, I mean, what is that? That is, you know, really the American dream. And so that was something that was constantly, I remember, being evoked in these pitch sessions.
Okay, that's Z Chun. The movie is Children of Invention. It screens at Sarasota Film Festival. Let me give the dates for you. Wednesday, April 1st, 6:45 p.m. Thursday, April 2nd at 5 p.m.
That sounds fascinating.
Yeah, another great narrative film.
Yeah.
We're really dividing it up tonight between narrative and documentary.
Yeah,
and
we are.
That's what the film festival is too. So
mm-hmm.
it's a good representation of that. Let's get to our final interview of the evening. I spoke to this gentleman just earlier today. Really unique documentary this is, and we'll bring that to you. And then on the flip side of that, we will. Close up. We'll be gone for 2 weeks, so we'll say our final
goodbyes. And
I wish I had like
you will have. You will have plenty to talk about when you
yeah.
come back on.
I wish I had like Auld Lang Syne or something to play.
Yeah, I know. Really, I was thinking that. Yeah,
it's just 2 weeks, but I mean, it feels like we've
eternity.
Never been gone that long.
Yeah.
Our next interview is with a director named Jim Granato, and his film is called Detour. You can read more about it at detourmovie.com. Fascinating. He's got a history in filmmaking, and a major portion of which is spent directing music videos. He's very astute about the world of music. And this is a particular portrait of a musician and a band that's on the rise now, and the specific health issues that this one band member has to undertake while maintaining his dream of being a musician.
Mm-hmm.
So here's Jim talking about his new movie, Detour, that will play at the Sarasota Film Festival, and I'll get the dates and times for you on the other side.
Okay. Detour is a film about musician Pat Spurgeon. He's also a good friend of mine. He plays in the band Rogue Wave, and basically he has been, you know, fulfilling his dreams as living as a professional musician, playing drums, among other instruments in the band, touring, you know, making a real life out of it, something he's been striving for a very long time. And, you know, good things really finally started to happen for Pat with this band. I mean, a band that he deeply cares about that were, you know, getting a lot of attention. So once these things were taking off, his kidney starts to fail.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, this is where Pat sort of, you know, kind of looks at a lot of things regarding his life and has to make a decision, you know, what if he has to give up basically all these things he's worked so hard for to really deal primarily with his health, or can he try and make it work doing both? Mm-hmm. And he chooses the latter. He chooses to try and do both. And so he basically takes the very necessary medicine or basically what's called dialysis, the treatment that he does to himself
right.
to sort of sustain himself, keep his kidney going. He takes it on the road, you know, mm. despite the grueling tour schedule that a band like Rogue Wave, you know, takes on every year, recording, et cetera. In addition to, you know, the dialysis itself, which he has to do twice a day, he's also looking for a potential living kidney donor, somebody who will, you know, donate the organ that he needs, because dialysis doesn't last forever. So
I have never thought of a backup plan. If you have a backup plan, you'll take it.
Can music is my entire world. It's all of my stress, it's all of my joy, it's all of my creativity. It's everything. I don't have anything else that I do. I sleep and I eat and I play music.
Pat Virgin.
We were passing through San Francisco. I stopped and did a little blood test because the doctors were concerned about something. We found out that I had this problem with my kidney deteriorating.
Are you hoping to get out of this mess?
And I called the doctors. They wanted me to start dialysis when I got home.
You're a bird on a wire.
My wait time is 6 years on the list. So 6 years on dialysis. This tube, what I do with it is I hook this bag up to that and I drain that out, and then I've got another bag that drains in. There's so many possible ways for me to get an infection because I have this direct line right into my abdomen where if I wanted to do myself in, I could do it like that if I wanted to. It's absolutely necessary to be healthy, and deep down I'm like, yeah, but I want a tour.
I knew that, you know, Pat, first and foremost, is my friend, and really he approached me at first saying, you know, we should try and do like a little video. We really thought that in the beginning of all this that maybe we just had come up with like a 10-minute video, a film that might be, you know, specifically for people that are in need of a kidney as well, like he is, you know, somebody who, you know, wouldn't lose hope, basically. And that, you know, we always thought that Pat, you know, would probably do just fine and probably get his kidney, I don't know. We didn't know when that was going to be, but we had no idea that, you know, 3 years would go by and 80 hours of footage later that all these twists and turns sort of took place. And within all that, yeah, I mean, the music and with Pat's personality, I mean, of course, that was on the foremost. I mean, that was like his life, and that became such a big part of the story that, you know, the music community themselves really kind of stepped up to the plate and helped out as well. You know, it was a, like, part music video. I wasn't sure what I was going to get. I knew it was going to be, music was a giant part of it, but to intervene it with this sort of serious medical health issue was a challenge, and I got to tell you, you know, telling people what I was working on, people were kind of scratching their heads. They weren't sure how it was going to work. You know,
<Yeah.
laughs> I wasn't sure either. I mean, but I think we got something rather unique and certainly, you know, an important story to share.
Well, that's the beauty and the danger of the documentary form is that it when it's good and when it's working, the story kind of evolves in front of your eyes, and you just have to go with it as a filmmaker. So
right.
I'm wondering, with 80 hours of footage, how do you know when you're done? How do you know when you've got it?
That's a great question. You could just keep going, I suppose. I mean, this film really is about this person's life, you know. And I don't want to reveal what happens in the end, but
right.
You know, we could keep going. Keep going, because, I mean, I think a lot of people who are familiar with dialysis or familiar with this issue know that, you know, it's not a permanent fix. So this is merely a chapter, maybe a series of chapters in one person's life, and he just has an interesting lifestyle. But, you know, how do you know when you're done? You know, you really – I got surprised so much along the way. You know, I wasn't sure. I thought I was done a good year or so before I actually finished the film. And then something happened, something important really, you know, kind of came up that we had to address for the film.
Yeah.
And, you know, and those decisions are hard because, you know, you're asking to spend a lot of money and a lot more time because you're really, I mean, as a filmmaker, you're editing and you're rethinking this thing completely, I mean, just all the time. It really can drain you at times. And I had to take breaks. But coming back to it, you know, you just, you know, kind of recognize all the pieces you have, and you just one day go, that's it. I'm just gonna make this work, and hopefully it works. does work. So.
Well, dialysis, and I know of people on dialysis, and it's grueling. The ones that I know are limited to in-office visits, and wherever they
right.
go, they have to make arrangements to go in office every day. And that must have been a very grueling experience for you to shoot, I would think.
It was. But, you know, that was kind of one of the first points that Pat and I wanted to sort of address as well, is that, first of all, the type of dialysis he took with him on the road was not what a lot of people are familiar with, which is called hemodialysis, which is where you
right.
go into a hospital or a clinic 3 or 4 days a week, and you're pretty much tethered to a machine where your blood is being sort of cleaned out, really. And it is quite something to see. Pat was doing something called peritoneal dialysis, which was very mobile. I mean, obviously, I mean, this guy was doing it to himself. And, you know, in addition to all the gear that he would haul back and forth from a van into, a, you know, some club, he had boxes and boxes of this fluid that, you know, was the dialysis itself. And it was basically the sugar water content that he would just sort of do these exchanges in his abdomen. And, you know, he would just do it to himself. And that was part of, obviously, that's what kind of makes us unique. You know, we sort of explore that. And again, people scratching their heads like, how can somebody do this? Because this, you know, obviously you have to have a, you have to be very sensitive with your surroundings and so forth. And here we are in some dingy nightclubs here and there, you know, doing it.
Yeah.
And, I mean, anything could have happened at any time. But Pat, you know, he's got a lot of optimism, and you know, there's a lot of perseverance going with this guy. So
yeah, and obviously his music means a lot to him. So I'm curious to know your point of view when you see him going through the grueling nature of the dialysis and the touring and the issues with his health. When he gets on stage and when he's performing, do you see a transformation occur in him?
I just see that Pat, you know, he doesn't think about it. He knows he has to do it. He's a pretty responsible guy. But when he's on stage or when he's playing, I mean, he gives it his all. And he certainly, you know, he knows his health is the most important thing in his life. But, you know, he just tries to take care of it. And then when he kind of zones in and he performs or records or whatever, you know, that becomes his priority. So, you know, in order to have that, he knows that he has to keep himself in check. So, yeah, is there a transformation kind of on screen? I mean, you see just, again, his dedication. It's just amazing. It's just amazing
yeah.
what he does. And, you know, again, and the risks involved, that what he puts on, because, I mean, I think a lot of people would just want to stay home. And he didn't want to stay home.
When you show this to an audience and it's going to have its world premiere at the film festival, the Sarasota Film Festival. What kind of conversations are you hoping this film inspires?
Well, you know, I think we obviously want to raise awareness about organ donation. I mean, that was the priority, really. I mean, there was this sort of, okay, let's first of all, the project started as let's show some of these other people that might be in similar, you know, straits that peritoneal dialysis exists and people, you know, can have some sort of freedom instead of going to these clinics. But, I mean, really, you know, the whole idea of organ donation, I think, is still a little bit in the dark for a lot of people. You know, most people would say, okay, well, I know that I can go to the DMV and register to become a donor, but it really doesn't just stop there. I mean, there is, you know, a lot of you can, God forbid, if somebody does die in an accident, I mean, your family, your relatives can put a stop to your wishes if they so see it, you know, of releasing your organs. So, I mean, that certainly is something we wanted to address. And
yeah.
and I think that it's just something that a lot of people really don't think about. I mean, it's part of our culture. We don't really think about death in this country, I don't think, very much. So,
yeah.
you know, and we don't want to think about it. But it happens, and unfortunately it happens to a lot of people way too soon. And, you know, we're just hoping, without being didactic or anything, just that people will, you know, have a sense of, you know, a little bit more a sense of choice in the matter.
The film is called Detour. Let me tell you when it plays at the film festival, Saturday, April 4th at 8:30 p.m. and Sunday, April 5th at 1:30 p.m. A great guy, He was very excited about doing the show, too. I think it was like his first official interview, if we can be referred to as an official.
We are official. So, no, that was good. That was very interesting.
Yeah, he was a great guy, and I'm sure it's a terrific movie. I can't wait to watch it. So there it is, 7 interviews with 7 filmmakers at this year's festival, and we've done 3 or 4 previously for this particular one this year.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So we've covered a lot, and who knows what might transpire at the film festival and who else I might be able to procure for future shows.
For future shows, and what kind of trouble you're going to get into with the company you're keeping.
Yeah, it's going to be like a bad sitcom, me and Aaron together. But, you know, I'm excited because by doing this show, we've opened up a door to so many people. Like last week when we spoke to John Voight and we spoke to Burt Young, and we had a great time with both of them. They'll both be there at the film festival. That gives me the confidence, having spoken to them on my turf.
No, of course.
And to approach them and to meet with them.
Honestly, I think what's good about it, because before I met you, before we did the show, I'd never heard of the Sarasota Film Festival. So right there, I mean, you've opened up this film festival that people all over the world. Mm. So, I mean, that's a big deal.
It is a very desirous place to have a film festival
as
well. It's a great area. But an hour and a half outside of where I live now.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if I had the means, I would attend all the festivals all over the country and the world, because so many of them are great. But this one in particular, this is the shining example of
right.
what a festival in this state can be.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Jealous of Keith because he goes to all these festivals.
He does. He gets around, man.
He does. Totally.
He's at Sarasota all week, the whole 10 days. And
mm-hmm.
He gave me his lineup of movies that he's seeing, and we're watching a couple of the same films. Let me tell you a couple of the movies that we haven't talked about yet that I'll be checking out.
Okay, yeah, please do.
There's one that I'm really excited about called Theater of War.
Yeah, I've heard of that, yeah.
And it's a portrait of actors as they rehearse, go through the rehearsal process and production process of a Brecht play.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of the name of the play that they're doing. But first and foremost, it's a way to see our first glimpse of Meryl Streep in the rehearsal process because she stars in the play.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I
wow.
mean, that's exciting.
Yeah, that is.
And that's the chief reason why I want to see it, because I come from stage experience,
mm-hmm.
and I like to view those difficulties in that journey that they
mm-hmm.
have in rehearsal, that
right.
journey of discovery that they go through. And there's lots of other great films, too, and I'm going to find it. Give me a second.
Okay.
You want to hum a few bars of something while my computer...
No, I'm not, let's not do that. We want people to listen to the show.
It's my favorite song.
God, I'm worried about you.
No,
are you going to see now that one with Woody Harrelson and The Messenger? Are you going to?
The Messenger is their opening night film, and unfortunately, I will be picking up Aaron at the airport for the opening night.
Oh my God, he's making you miss that. Okay.
They might rescreen it, and I'll be able to check it out. Here it is. Picking up Aaron from the airport, he's staying with me at my house Friday night. We're going Saturday morning, spending a night at a Days Inn, Saturday, Sunday. Coming back Monday night to watch 24. And then I'm taking him back to the airport like at 6 o'clock in the morning the next day. So it really will be like the Odd Couple. Yeah. I'm seeing a movie called The Window,
mm-hmm.
The English Surgeon, which is about a brain surgeon who does charity work, I believe. A movie called Moon with Sam Rockwell and Kevin Spacey.
Oh, that's supposed to be really good.
It's directed by David Bowie's son. It's supposed to be a really unique sci-fi movie. Herb and Dorothy, which is about a documentary about the two most unlikely art collectors
mm-hmm.
in the world. The Burning Plain, which is the directing debut of the screenwriter of Babel, I believe.
Oh, that should be interesting.
Charlize Theron and Kim Basinger. all the movies that we've talked about tonight, I'll be going to see. Julia, which is the new Tilda Swinton movie.
And that's supposed to be good.
Yeah, Crude, which is the Joe Berlinger documentary about oil.
Mm-hmm.
Berlinger's great. The Paradise Lost.
Oh, Paradise Lost 1 and 2 are excellent.
Yeah, I was going to go see Three Blind Mice, and then I realized I have that at home here, and I have so I'll go see something else.
Why are you making me try? You're going to make me. He's going to listen. Never mind.
No, I have it right here at home, so I'll be watching
okay.
it. Cover
oh, oh, okay. I thought you meant something. All right, never mind.
No,
I,
not
edit
the nursery.
Edit that out of the final show.
not the nursery rhyme, Three Blind Mice. Oh, no, you were thinking of the person.
Yes, I was thinking of something.
One blind mouse. Looking to Get Out. Winnebago Man, which we've heard a lot about from South by Southwest. Light Bulb, which is a new movie with Jeremy Renner and Dallas Roberts. Tyson. Oh, Tyson.
Now that's the big one, I would think, besides the Hal Ashby one. That's the big one. The
yeah, yeah. That Evening Sun, which I just read a review of this today, a shining Hal Holbrook performance, another powerhouse performance from him. They say it's a great, great movie.
Mm, cool.
A new Michael Shannon movie called The Missing Person. And there's another film, their closing film, which is called Every Little Step. It's about a Chorus Line, the Broadway show, and the preparations
right.
for that. And that show's been around forever, obviously. I think it holds the record for the longest run.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Good stuff. Jerry, I will miss you. But I will
miss you, but have a great time this weekend and next weekend, and I'm sure you're going to have a lot to talk about when we come back.
I definitely will be in touch every day, giving
okay.
you my reports on my adventures.
Okay.
Thank you all so much for joining us tonight. Look at the SarasotaFilmFestival.com website, and send me emails, send us emails, tell us what you like about the show, what future content you'd like to hear. MovieGeeksUnited@Yahoo.com is the email. Jerry, I've enjoyed this very much.
Yes, this was great.
Yeah.
Enjoy. Good night.
Good times.
Great
good night, Jerry.
All right, good night.